Chapter 18. Clearly of a mind free from all disavowed devices. Pluses of honor had been kept for the mislameters near the head of the principal tea table in the wainscoted parlor, now looking fresh and pleasant with handsome branches of holly, yew, and laurel, from the abundant growths of the old garden, and Nancy felt an inward flutter that no firmness of purpose could prevent when she saw Mr. Godfrey Cass advancing to lead her to a seat between himself and Mr. Crickenthorpe, while Priscilla was called to the opposite side between her father and the squire. It certainly did make some difference to Nancy that the loveress he had given up was the young man of quite the highest consequence in the parish at home in a venerable and unique parlor, which was the extremity of grandeur in her experience, a parlor where she might one day have been mistress, with the consciousness that she was spoken of as Adam Cass, the squire's wife. These circumstances exalted her inward drama in her own eyes, and deepened the emphasis with which she declared to herself that not the most dazzling rank should induce her to marry a man whose conduct showed him careless of his character, but that love once, love always, was the motto of a true and pure woman, and no man should ever have any right over her which would be a call on her to destroy the dried flowers that she treasured, and always would treasure, for Godfrey Cass's sake. And Nancy was capable of keeping her word to herself under very trying conditions. Nothing but a becoming blush betrayed the moving thoughts that urged themselves upon her as she accepted the seat next to Mr. Crickenthorpe. For she was so instinctively neat and adroit in all her actions, and her pretty lips met each other with such quiet firmness, that it would have been difficult for her to appear agitated. It was not the rector's practice to let a charming blush pass without an appropriate compliment. He was not in the least lofty or aristocratic, but simply a merry-eyed, small-featured, gray-haired man, with his chin propped by an ample, many-creased white neckcloth which seemed to predominate over every other point in his person, and somehow to impress its peculiar character on his remarks, so that to have considered his amenities apart from his cravat would have been a severe, and perhaps a dangerous, effort of abstraction. "Ah, Miss Nancy," he said, turning his head within his cravat and smiling down pleasantly upon her, "when anybody pretends this has been a severe winter, I shall tell them I saw the roses blooming on New Year's Eve. Eh, Godfrey, what do you say?" Godfrey made no reply, and avoided looking at Nancy very markedly. For though these complimentary personalities were held to be in excellent taste in old-fashioned Raveloe society, reverent love has a politeness of its own which it teaches to men otherwise of small schooling. But the squire was rather impatient at Godfrey's showing himself a dull spark in this way. By this advanced hour of the day, the squire was always in higher spirits than we have seen him in at the breakfast table, and felt it quite pleasant to fulfill the hereditary duty of being noisily jovial and patronizing. The large silver snuff box was in active service, and was offered without fail to all neighbors from time to time, however often they might have declined the favor. At present, the squire had only given an express welcome to the heads of families as they appeared, but always as the evening deepened, his hospitality rayed out more widely, till he had tapped the youngest guests on the back, and shown a peculiar fondness for their presence, in the full belief that they must feel their lives made happy by their belonging to a parish, where there was such a hearty man as Squire Cass to invite them, and wish them well. Even in this early stage of the jovial mood, it was natural that he should wish to supply his son's deficiencies by looking and speaking for him. "Aye, he began, offering his snuff box to Mr. Lammeter, who for the second time bowed his head and waved his hand in stiff rejection of the offer. "Us old fellows may wish ourselves young tonight when we see the mistletoe bow in the white parlor. It's true, most things are gone backward in these last 30 years. The country's going down since the old king fell ill. But when I look at Miss Nancy here, I begin to think the lasses keep up their quality. Ding me if I remember a sample to match her, not when I was a fine young fellow, and thought a deal about my pigtail. No offense to you, madam, he added, bending to Mrs. Crickenthorpe, who sat by him. I didn't know you when you were as young as Miss Nancy here. Mrs. Crickenthorpe, a small blinking woman, who fidgeted incessantly with her lace, ribbons, and gold chain, turning her head about and making subdued noises, very much like a guinea pig that twitches its nose and soliloquizes in all company indiscriminately, now blinked and fidgeted towards the squire, and said, oh, no, no offense. This emphatic compliment of the squire's to Nancy was felt by others besides Godfrey to have a diplomatic significance, and her father gave a slight additional erectness to his back as he looked across the table at her with complacent gravity. That grave and orderly senior was not going to bate a jot of his dignity by seeming elated at the notion of a match between his family and the squire's. He was gratified by any honor paid to his daughter, but he must see an alteration in several ways before his consent would be vouchsafed. His spare but healthy person, and high-featured firm face, that looked as if it had never been flushed by excess, was in strong contrast, not only with the squire's, but with the appearance of the Raveloe farmers generally, in accordance with a favorite saying of his own, that reed was stronger than pasture. Miss Nancy's wonderful like what her mother was, though, isn't she, Kimball? Said the stout lady of that name, looking round for her husband. But Dr. Kimball, country apothecaries in old days enjoyed that title without authority of diploma, being a thin and agile man, was flitting about the room with his hands in his pockets, making himself agreeable to his feminine patients with medical impartiality, and being welcomed everywhere as a doctor by hereditary right, not one of those miserable apothecaries who canvass for practice in strange neighborhoods and spend all their income in starving their one horse, but a man of substance, able to keep an extravagant table like the best of his patients. Time out of mind, the Raveloe doctor had been a Kimball. Kimball was inherently a doctor's name, and it was difficult to contemplate firmly the melancholy fact that the actual Kimball had no son, so that his practice might one day be handed over to a successor with the incongruous name of Taylor or Johnson. But in that case, the wiser people in Raveloe would employ Dr. Blick of Flitton as less unnatural. Did you speak to me, my dear? Said the authentic doctor, coming quickly to his wife's side. But, as if foreseeing that she would be too much out of breath to repeat a remark, he went on immediately, ah, Miss Priscilla, the sight of you revives the taste of that super excellent pork pie. I hope the batch isn't near an end. Yes, indeed, it is, doctor, said Priscilla, but I'll answer for it the next shall be as good. My pork pies don't turn out well by chance. Not as your doctoring does, eh, Kimball? Because folks forget to take your physic, eh? Said the squire, who regarded physic and doctors as many loyal churchmen regard the church, and the clergy tasting a joke against them when he was in health, but impatiently eager for their aid when anything was the matter with him. He tapped his box, and looked round with a triumphant laugh. Ah, as he has a quick wit, my friend Priscilla has, said the doctor, choosing to attribute the epigram to a lady, rather than allow a brother-in-law that advantage over him. He saves a little pepper to sprinkle over her talk. That's the reason why she never puts too much into her pies. There's my wife now, she never has an answer at her tongue's end. But if I offend her, she's sure to scarify my throat with black pepper the next day, or else give me the colic with watery greens. That's an awful tit for tat. Here the vivacious doctor made a pathetic grimace. Did you ever hear the like? Said Mrs. Kimball, laughing above her double chin with much good humor, aside to Mrs. Crickenthorpe, who blinked and nodded, and seemed to intend a smile, which, by the correlation of forces, went off in small twitchings and noises. I suppose that's the sort of tit-for-tat adopted in your profession, Kimball, if you've a grudge against a patient, said the rector. Never do have a grudge against our patients, said Mr. Kimball, except when they leave us. And then, you see, we haven't the chance of prescribing for him. Ah, Miss Nancy, he continued, suddenly skipping to Nancy's side, you won't forget your promise? You're to save a dance for me, you know. Come, come, Kimball, don't you be too forward, said the squire. Give the young uns fair play. There's my son Godfrey'll be wanting to have a round with you, if you run off with Miss Nancy. He's bespoke her for the first dance, I'll be bound. Eh, sir? What do you say, he continued, throwing himself backward, and looking at Godfrey. Haven't you asked Miss Nancy to open the dance with you? Godfrey, sorely uncomfortable under this significant insistence about Nancy, and afraid to think where it would end by the time his father had set his usual hospitable example of drinking before and after supper, saw no course open, but to turn to Nancy and say, with as little awkwardness as possible, no, I've not asked her yet, but I hope she'll consent, if somebody else hasn't been before me. No, I've not engaged myself, said Nancy, quietly, though blushingly. If Mr. Godfrey founded any hopes on her consenting to dance with him, he would soon be undeceived. But there was no need for her to be uncivil. Then I hope you've no objections to dancing with me, said Godfrey, beginning to lose the sense that there was anything uncomfortable in this arrangement. No, no objections, said Nancy, in a cold tone. Ah, well, you're a lucky fellow, Godfrey, said Uncle Kimball, but you're my godson, so I won't stand in your way. Else I'm not so very old, eh, my dear, he went on, skipping to his wife's side again. Who wouldn't mind my having a second, after you were gone, not if I cried a good deal first? Come, come, take a cup of tea and stop your tongue. Do, said good-humored Mrs. Kimball, feeling some pride in a husband who must be regarded as so clever and amusing by the company generally. If he had only not been irritable at cards. While safe, well-tested personalities were enlivening the tea in this way, the sound of the fiddle approaching within a distance at which it could be heard distinctly, made the young people look at each other with sympathetic impatience for the end of the meal. Why, there's Solomon in the hall, said the squire, and playing my favorite tune, I believe, the flaxen-headed plowboy, he's for giving us a hint as we aren't enough in a hurry to hear him play. Bob, he called out to his third long-legged son, who was at the other end of the room, open the door, and tell Solomon to come in. He shall give us a tune here. Bob obeyed, and Solomon walked in, fiddling as he walked, for he would on no account break off in the middle of a tune. Here, Solomon, said the squire, with loud patronage. I'm here, my man. Ah, I knew it was the flaxen-headed plowboy. There's no finer tune. Solomon Macy, a small, hale old man with an abundant crop of long white hair reaching nearly to his shoulders, advanced to the indicated spot, bowing reverently while he fiddled, as much as to say that he respected the company, though he respected the keynote more. As soon as he had repeated the tune, and lowered his fiddle, he bowed again to the squire and the rector, and said, I hope I see your honor and your reverence well, and wishing you health and long life and a happy new year. And wishing the same to you, Mr. Lammeter, sir, and to the other gentlemen, and the madams, and the young lasses. As Solomon uttered the last words, he bowed in all directions solicitously, lest he should be wanting in due respect. But thereupon he immediately began to prelude, and fell into the tune which he knew would be taken as a special compliment by Mr. Lammeter. Thank ye, Solomon, thank ye, said Mr. Lammeter when the fiddle paused again. Hats for the hills and far away, that is. My father used to say to me, whenever we heard that tune, Ah, lad, I come from over the hills and far away. There's a many tunes I don't make head or tail of, but that speaks to me like the blackbird's whistle. I suppose it's the name. There's a deal in the name of a tune. But Solomon was already impatient to prelude again, and presently broke with much spirit into Roger de Coverley, at which there was a sound of chairs pushed back, and laughing voices. Aye, Solomon, we know what that means, said the squire, rising. 'Tis time to begin the dance, eh? Lead the way, then, and we'll all follow you. So Solomon, holding his white head on one side, and playing vigorously, marched forward at the head of the gay procession into the white parlor, where the mistletoe bough was hung, and multitudinous tallow candles made rather a brilliant effect, gleaming from among the buried holly boughs, and reflected in the old-fashioned oval mirrors fastened in the panels of the white wainscot. A quaint procession. Old Solomon, in his seedy clothes and long white locks, seemed to be luring that decent company by the magic scream of his fiddle, luring discreet matrons in turban-shaped caps, nay, Mrs. Crickenthorpe herself, the summit of whose perpendicular feather was on a level with the squire's shoulder, luring fair lasses complacently conscious of very short waists and skirts blameless of front folds, luring burly fathers in large variegated waistcoats, and ruddy sons, for the most part shy and sheepish, in short nether garments and very long coattails. Already Mr. Macy and a few other privileged villagers, who were allowed to be spectators on these great occasions, were seated on benches placed for them near the door, and great was the admiration and satisfaction in that quarter, when the couples had formed themselves for the dance, and the squire led off with Mrs. Crickenthorpe, joining hands with the rector and Mrs. Osgood. That was as it should be, that was what everybody had been used to, and the charter of Raveloe seemed to be renewed by the ceremony. It was not thought of as an unbecoming levity for the old and middle-aged people to dance a little before sitting down to cards, but rather as part of their social duties. For what were these, if not to be merry at appropriate times, interchanging visits and poultry with due frequency, paying each other old established compliments in sound traditional phrases, passing well-tried personal jokes, urging your guests to eat and drink too much out of hospitality, and eating and drinking too much in your neighbor's house to show that you like your cheer. And the parson naturally set an example in these social duties. For it would not have been possible for the Raveloe mind, without a peculiar revelation, to know that a clergyman should be a pale-faced memento of solemnities, instead of a reasonably faulty man whose exclusive authority, to read prayers and preach, to christen, marry, and bury you, necessarily coexisted with the right to sell you the ground to be buried in, and to take tithe in kind. On which last point, of course, there was a little grumbling, but not to the extent of your religion, not of deeper significance than the grumbling at the rain, which was by no means accompanied with a spirit of impious defiance, but with a desire that the prayer for fine weather might be read forthwith. There was no reason, then, why the rector's dancing should not be received as part of the fitness of things quite as much as the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.